hold in our hearts. The next item in the service will be the offering, and I'm going to start with words from John Saxon. We have all been warmed by fires we did not make, but fires cannot burn without fuel. The time, the energy, the imagination, the vision, the creativity, the compassion, and the love of the members and friends of this community all fuel our mission and nurture and sustain a welcome, inclusive, and diverse liberal religious community. And so does our financial support for this physical space where we make our spiritual home. If you are visiting or returning after an absence or otherwise constrained, please feel free to let the offering basket pass you by.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Wonderful. Thank you for inviting me here. It's such an honor to be able to come speak to you as a student of theology and ministry at Seattle University. The fact that you open your pulpit to me is a gift, and to be able to practice. And one thing that I would like to note as I speak to you today about a kindergarten teacher is I'd like us to consider her as one of the grandmothers of Unitarian Universalism in the way that Vi Hilbert is one of our grandmothers here. And one of the buildings, a new building at Seattle U, was just dedicated to Vi. It's a dormitory for new undergraduate students. So I feel a connection there. So our hymn that we just sang is a hymn by William Ellery Channing, who is known for preaching a sermon, the first sermon to claim the name Unitarian, which in Boston at that time in the mid-19th century, so mid-1800s, was actually used as an epithet, those Unitarians. So he was the first to reclaim that label and say, proudly, my church, we will be Unitarian Christians at the time. And so Elizabeth Palmer Peabody was a contemporary of Channing's, and as a kindergarten teacher, her words did not make it into our hymnal. So I would like to offer a meditation today, and you can hear in her words what her faith sounded like as a Congregationalist Christian who associated with William Channing and the Transcendentalists and the other religious thinkers of her day. Well, this is a short prayer and poem. The little flower that opens in the meadows lives and dies in a season. But what agencies have concentrated themselves to produce it? So the human soul lives in the midst of heavenly help. Children are such a gift to us, aren't they? That little bit of laughter just brings a smile to our faces. And the way that European Americans tell history, we usually focus on big names. People who stood out and spoke or acted in ways that broke the mold, that were visible. Many of these names are the names of men. And so when I was invited initially to speak with you about you history, I was worried that that might be what you were looking for, signs of greatness, and that you would only want the names perhaps of the standout preachers and writers, big names like William Ellery Channing or Ralph Waldo Emerson. But in this version of history, someone like Elizabeth Palmer Peabody, her story would not be told. This way of telling history is like having selective memory, like picking a flower without knowing all of the roots that are underground, that draw from the minerals, that filter through the soil, that nourish that flower. Remember, each one of these people who we come to know in our history was also a product of their times. And they became who they were because of their relationships with everyone else. They were networked. They became who they were because of the events in which they participated, most of which were completely outside of their control. Perhaps some of you have read the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. He calls it a story of success, and he makes a compelling case that great people are not simply born with talent. Instead, they come out of communities, out of circumstances that form a kind of cresting wave or a groundswell, and they happen to be the one lifted up on it, riding it, surfing it. And so while they are unique individuals with unique talents, they are in fact shaped and influenced and tempered by conflicts with others and also lifted up by others. And I say all of this because I see Elizabeth Palmer Peabody as one of those very important people in a web of relationships that lifted up these great names like Emerson and Channing. She's someone we wouldn't see otherwise because she was part of that root system. And so as I tell her story today, I'm also wondering, what are you looking for when you go into your history? Because let's be honest, in European American culture, we're very ahistoric. Waves upon waves of immigration have encouraged leaving behind ethnic histories from Europe, from South America, from Africa and Asia, in order to learn English and adapt to ways that were very influenced by English, Anglo-Saxon ways. There's a lot of focus in our culture on future, on progress, on growth. It's rare that we even look to history in times of distress to see what has happened before, to go back and look and see, is this a cycle? Is there some other time we can look to that is similar to our times? And yet all of the religious traditions emphasize genealogies, remembering and honoring our ancestors. And so I hope that as I tell more of Elizabeth Palmer Peabody's story, you will hear some threads of similarities between her and her time and ours. I think looking at history this way helps us face the unknown with a sense that our ancestors have our backs because we're here because of them. As I approach Peabody's story, I do so not with the kind of confidence that we tend to expect of our public speakers, not the sense that I'm going to come tell you the story in a way that is compelling and concise, and you're going to go home and say, now I know who she is. Do any of you have clear storylines or plots to your lives? I know I don't. And so I began reading Peabody with some hesitance. I didn't want to do injustice to her story or read too much of my own interest into hers. And so haltingly, I read several different biographies and discovered that each biographical author portrayed her in a different light. I learned about four or five different Elizabeth Peabodys. Who is she? I'm still not sure. The stories we tell depends on who's telling it and why. Let me share some examples. By now you're probably wondering, okay, get on with it, who is she? So one story is that she lived in Boston in a very heady time, also in other parts of New England. And the economic boom beginning in the 1830s through the 1850s and 60s. This was a time when over 75% of today's wealth in America was made and then passed down in the generations by a handful of wealthy European Americans. Accumulated into the hands of a few, this was an important time. Wealthy merchants and Boston business people attended a Congregationalist church, which happens to become the first Unitarian church where William Ellery Channing preached. Some of them were slave owners. Peabody was a witness to the rise of the abolitionist movement. She was a witness to heated debates and changes in the church, to calls for Channing to take a more firm stand on slavery, which he reluctantly did because he would then face criticism from wealthy church members who then left the church taking their money with them. She was a witness as Unitarian Christian views emerged that there was one God, not a trinity of three persons, of God and Jesus and the Holy Spirit. She was a witness to universalist ideologies that said everyone can be saved, everyone can go to heaven, and then much discussion about how that would happen. Would there be a time of atonement before getting into heaven? Because, I mean, if you did things that were morally reprehensible, shouldn't there be some kind of reckoning? This was a very intense time. New ideas that wrestled with more orthodox Christian views. Peabody as a witness to her times. Another story is that she was a woman scholar who was fascinated by and deeply knowledgeable of religious and philosophical ideas, and she had a capacity for turning those ideas into reality. At the age of 9, she first heard William Channing preach and was so taken with his ideas that she became his scribe and secretary at the age of 9. Can you imagine that? Have you ever heard such a compelling preacher? You don't have to be nice to me today. The summer that she turned 13 years old, she convinced her parents that she could make up her own mind about her own religious views. Sound familiar, anyone? And she did this by reading the New Testament 30 times. Channing himself eventually took to going on walks with her to sound out his sermon ideas and get her input as his sounding board before he wrote his sermons. This point in her story gave me a little bit of pause, and I wondered what her capacity for scholarship might have given her to preach. She had access to these new ideas of Unitarianism. What prevented her from having her own pulpit and her own church? One of the obvious answers might be gender. She's a woman at that time. But there's more to it. There's another part of her story that stands out to me. At 12 years old, she started a school. not because she was a remarkable person, but because her father's income was unreliable, and she was the eldest of three girls, and someone needed to provide for the family. And because she could read, and because she could write, and the office of teacher was available to educated women at that time, she became a tutor and started a small school. Another one of our stories about Peabody is that she is a great Unitarian Universalist forebear and a model of our churches, the way that we do them now, as you and you. She, in one of her iterations of her life, opened and ran a bookstore in Boston, a religious bookstore. She hosted salons and Bible study circles for Unitarian women to gather and talk about the new ideas they were hearing. She contributed her own knowledge about the biblical texts she had studied. She welcomed the new transcendentalists, Emerson and Thoreau, and she became the publisher of their very first journal. She published their journal. Some of Emerson's most well-known writings came from her organization. And what I loved when I read this was that when these transcendentalists didn't get their written material in on time for her publishing deadline, she just wrote the rest of the material herself. So she was also an entrepreneur and a champion of new religious ideas and an author herself. In a way, I see her in her bookstore as the first church administrator, doing all of the jobs, pulling together the order of service, writing something for the newsletter when the preacher doesn't finish it on time. There were some unsympathetic sources that I read. One painted her as an unmarried spinster who founded the kindergarten movement and seems to imply she had nothing better to do as an unmarried woman than to develop what has now become a mandatory school experience. I suspected that this author didn't have a very good school experience. Although it is true that she never married. She made sure that her two younger sisters married, and married well. One married Horace Mann, and the other married Nathaniel Hawthorne. She was well connected, did I mention? She was the web, she was the glue that held people together of this time. Fortunately, there's another more sympathetic author I read who glowingly described her transatlantic communications with the founders of the German kindergarten movement and her very deliberate and intentional and thoughtful moves to create a paradise where all children could learn, regardless of their economic background. So stepping back a little bit from these stories that I pulled out of the different sources, I started reflecting on what did I see in her story that comes from me and that comes from our times. And one of the things that I noticed is that as a young adult and a youth, she was tutoring educated or wealthy children, children of wealthy families. She brought her sisters into a wealthy and literate world. But that is not the background that they came from. She didn't teach or run the bookstore necessarily because she had a great vision, but out of necessity. She needed income. She needed a job. She had to support her sisters. She couldn't have become a preacher. She couldn't have gone to school. Harvard at that time was just transitioning into becoming the Unitarian Theological Seminary. But Peabody had to work. And so when we celebrate her for launching the kindergarten movement in the US, I think it's important to pause and wonder, what was it about this idea of a kindergarten that caught fire with her? What caught her imagination about this that made her willing to give it a try and take it a risk? at this time, there was no public education. She really was a pioneering visionary. And for me, it's tempting to imagine that she was incredibly virtuous and altruistic, because I look up to virtuous and altruistic people, because I myself find that I am not nearly as virtuous and altruistic as I might like to be. And I imagine her envisioning a better way to create a beautiful learning paradise. But I also wonder if part of her drive was envy. That the children she taught received so much, and yet there were many, many children who didn't have that opportunity, including her. I wondered if she wanted to create this garden paradise for children because she worked so hard to piece together her own education in her own way. And so perhaps her gift, which continues today, clearly, not only came out of her great capacity to turn new philosophical ideas into action, but also from her own pain and her own woundedness. That's what I imagine in her story. That she had a hope that children could have what she did not. I'd like to tell you just a little bit about my journey into ministry. Why am I here? Standing in the pulpit in your lovely church here this morning. And I would say it's partly out of a gift for building community, because I see in myself also this ability to connect people to one another, although I haven't been as good a matchmaker as Peabody was for her sisters. Better luck next time. But I also come to this from my own painful experience of not having a community growing up. I grew up in secular culture. I went to kindergarten, and I did not belong in my classroom. I had two teachers, one Mr. Jones, who I loved dearly, who was a substitute for 3 months while our teacher was on maternity leave. And whenever the kids would get restless and rowdy, he'd pull out his guitar and we'd circle up and he'd sing a song. And imagine that, it calmed everybody down. It was a garden paradise. Our teacher, when she came back from leave, was, can you imagine it? A little bit distracted. Maybe wishing she was at home with her own child. I don't know, but we didn't get along. And as a result, my parents moved me to a new school, and then another new school, and then my mother joined the Air Force, and we moved to Germany because she said there are better schools there. It was quite the voyage. And so I went to many different schools growing up. We traveled quite a bit. And so the community I came to identify with is wherever we were at the present. But I think I hungered for a depth of connection that I hadn't found living in one place for 1 year or 2 years, or being in one school for 2 years at a time. And so I would invite you to consider, as the sun comes out and maybe the spring is arriving as Susan requested, that one of the best gifts we can offer each other in this kind of community is the art of hosting. The art of making someone welcome as quickly as possible, not knowing how long they'll be here or how many times their life will go through transitions. Let's channel Elizabeth Palmer Peabody, not for a kindergarten, but a people garden. I would like our churches to be people gardens where we as web weavers connect and engage, moving information, providing tea and cookies and kindness, a place where we can go and learn and share what's in our hearts and ask the big questions. I believe that hosting is a spiritual act. I believe it is a creative and a political act to host and bring people together. And it's a powerful act because it's not necessarily about the content of what arrives in the space, but about making a space at all for creativity and connection to thrive. So when I look into the many tellings and stories for Elizabeth Palmer Peabody, I'm not looking for the real one to stand up. I'm just looking for a reflection of something from our ancestors to take to you as a gift for today. And that's something worth continuing in our time, I think, is the art of hosting. And so whether you host school kids in your life, or clients at work, or business meetings, or your grandchildren, maybe an exchange student, or whether you host meals at the homeless shelter, you are continuing in the line of one of our important UU forebears. I find it helpful and hopeful to look into history in this way, to remember that it's many, many ordinary acts of care that add up. I love the quote by Margaret Mead, "Never doubt that a small, thoughtful group of committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." And so what I hope you take home today is encouragement to look at the ordinary ways in which you give of yourself, in which you host others, and share what you have, remembering that you are part of a web of people who are doing the same. I'll leave you with one final thought by a more recent UU minister, whose books you have in your library back in the office, and whose last name I'm never sure how to pronounce, but it's Robert Fulghum, who wrote a very important book entitled, and I have it right here, "All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten." And in this book he says, number one, share everything. Play fair. Put things back where you found them. Don't take things that aren't yours. Say you're sorry when you hurt somebody. Warm cookies and cold milk are good for you. Try to live a balanced life. Learn some. Think some. Draw and paint and sing and dance and play and work every day some. Most importantly, be aware of wonder. When you go out in the world, watch for traffic, hold hands and stick together, and remember the little seeds, how the roots go down and the plant goes up, and nobody really knows how or why, but we are all like that. So let us go forth and share, like our kindergarten teachers told us to. Let us share with encouragement in our hearts to love and to serve, to use compassion and curiosity, reverence and respect while seeking our truths, to share our toys and our gifts, and in this way, this sacred moment shall endure. May it be so.